Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, folks, I'm excited about our conversation today because I am reunited with my old buddy, Rick Unger, host of the nationally syndicated Rick Unger Show, as well as a Sirius XM co-host with me on the Steele and Unger Show back in the day. Yeah, he's a progressive who likes to tangle with the conservatives. So, you know, there's often one of two things, blood or beer on the floor. We'll see which winds up being the case today. But we're excited because we're going to talk about the midterm elections, the January 6th commission, as well as the evolving nature and alliances that are being formed in the gun discussion around gun reform. So Rick has a lot to say about that. Glad you could be a part of the conversation coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, like I said in the intro, he is a dumb man. He is none
other
than
dumb man.
Man is Rick Unger, and my old partner from the Steele and Unger days. Welcome back to the podcast, baby.
It has been a few minutes, man. We haven't done this in a while.
Well, look, you were the one going off there doing all this, you know, wild and, you know, crazy stuff people do when they supposedly retire or think they're going to do something else. And I just, no. So it's been a while, but we're back.
Mostly I'm just watching TV. It's great.
Nothing wrong with that. So I was telling Rick, folks, before we came on, this conversation is tailor-made for Steele and Unger because it hits on all the appropriate hot spots, the good and the bad and the ugly of the last couple of weeks that we've seen play out across the nation. This is a potpourri. We can start anywhere you really want. You've got January 6th commission, you've got the gun debate and the big rally this past weekend, and the Senate Republicans apparently now saying, oh yeah, we've always wanted gun reform, and midterm elections coming up. Where would you like to go first, my friend?
Let's start with the January 6th commission, because some of my reactions might surprise.
Oh, well, then let's get into that bad boy. So here's the landscape, folks. So for the first time in well over a generation, two generations, you had the country apparently transfixed on a congressional hearing. The last known time really that commanded that kind of attention was the Watergate hearings. And 20 million plus people tuned in, which shocked everybody. That was a little quick sidebar. It was the reaction from a lot of folks out there that 18 to 20 million people actually sat down and watched the thing.
Unless you are a Trump supporter. Because if you were a Trump supporter, you were busy on Facebook and social media talking about what an abject failure it was that in prime time, it only could get 20 million people.
Yeah, right. And look, not the All-Star game, the World Series.
Nothing. The final game of the World Series last year, 4 million something.
Yeah, these guys.
You know, I actually used it as a lesson with a friend of mine who is a Republican, who is a Trump supporter, and who's posting articles saying, oh my God, what a disappointment. And I went, dude, you know, you're entitled to your point of view and you're entitled to whatever information is going to make you feel better about your point of view. But you got to understand that when you put things up like that, I said, and by the way, Democrats who are busy on social media saying, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. They're full of shit too.
Right.
The fact of the matter is it was well within the range, you know, for a presidential State of the Union, it runs between 30 and 40 million. For a congressional hearing, 20 million is on the higher side. It's not the end all be all, but it sure as hell is not some kind of a disappointment.
No.
So, you know, all you do is when you say stuff like that is anybody who's going to take the trouble to actually do the research to find out what's what, they're going to go, well, you're not a very good analyst. You may be a good cheerleader, but you're not a good analyst.
Yeah, and I think the thing that for me that made that 20 million, because you're right, that it falls within a range for hearings and things that Congress does.
What
made it interesting for me is that the country has not been dialed into this conversation.
No,
the country has not been dialed into the January 6th hearings. They've been going on for quite some time now. There's all been all kinds of dance around whether or not they were reaching people, they were successful, and then, you know, little fights here and there that would pop up. The fact that the country did, in fact, take a moment and tune in, to me, was salient. So having said that, now that we've done with the Nielsen part of the program, what do you think the general impression that most Americans took away from that opening salvo?
Yeah, it's a great question, because you know you can weed out a large part of the public. Those who are ardent Trump supporters, this is not going to have much of an impact on them. Those who are ardent Trump opposers, they're pretty set too in how they feel about this. So what you're really playing for are people who might be persuadable. It's been persuasive. It has. I mean, there's so far there hasn't been a lot new that if you've been following along with this, you didn't already know, but you did get to see some of it. You got to, you know, we had heard about what Bill Barr had to say, but now we got to actually see him say it. But there is a flaw, Michael, and it's a flaw that's bothering me. And I think I understand why it has to be, but it's going to take away from the ability to persuade. I genuinely miss cross-examination. Now, the witnesses aren't much in the way of witnesses. I don't think any one of them has spoken for more than a total of 3 to 5 minutes. You know, it's really a show for the people on the panel. But I miss the opportunity to hear somebody who has a differing point of view pose questions to those witnesses.
Well, presumably that's taking place. But presumably that's taking place inside the hearings, correct?
No, I don't think it is, because there's nobody on that panel who is want to do that. I mean, look, if this had been set up the way it should have been set up, and the fault is clearly with McCarthy and the Republicans, you would have had a panel with Republican inquisitors and Democratic inquisitors. The problem is McCarthy tried to stack it. He didn't want inquisitors. He wanted disruptors. He wanted Jim Jordan,
right?
He wanted people who would mess it up. And I can certainly understand why Nancy Pelosi wasn't going along with that. But, you know, wouldn't it be nice when you've got witnesses who are making certain statements and averring certain things, if there was somebody from the other side to say, well, wait, let's take a closer look at that. And I'm missing that. So the whole thing does feel, I think it's all true. I don't think anybody's lying or feathering, but it feels totally one-sided.
And that's interesting, because that's an interesting point, because my view of it is I don't need that. For some reason, and you actually now have me thinking a little bit more about it, but I don't know if that's something that I really need. Do I really need, after 4 years of the bullshit out of the Trump team, Trump and the pacifiers and appeasers and liars on behalf of Trump, particularly folks like a Jim Jordan?
Would have disrupted. They would not have edified.
To sit there. And so then the question begs, who would have been that rational player who would sit there and objectively prosecute the other way to say, okay, I understand Attorney General Barr, but when you say that the president was not in his right mind about these things, give me an example.
Yeah, what do you mean?
What do you mean?
You're right. Unfortunately, that's the reality of the situation. We don't have a Congress any longer where you can get that. Let's go back to the Watergate hearings. I know you remember them.
Yeah.
I remember them being older than you. You did have that. You didn't have Republicans or Democrats on that committee grandstanding. You didn't have Democrats taking political shots. The Republicans weren't busy trying to make Dick Nixon look good. They were really asking questions, trying to get to a certain, you know, truth. Wouldn't it be nice if we still had a Congress that was like that? Yeah, it couldn't be, because I don't think you could have found four or five members for that committee from the Republican side who would not have been busy playing games. And what a shame that is. What a shame that is. And shame on McCarthy for not attempting to at least try and find members who would, you know, be, from their point of view, fair-minded and ask questions. Then on the other hand, though, there wouldn't be much to ask, because these witnesses, I genuinely wonder in most cases why they're even there, because they are literally saying nothing. It's the questioner, whether it be Lofgren or whether it be Thompson or Cheney, they're doing all the talking. And for anybody who's watching, you know, not even other members of the committee are saying anything. It's just the questioner. And the testimony is literally only a few minutes.
No, it is. And that's part of the problem in one sense. But I think from a practical standpoint, it makes sense to do it the way they're doing it, because they're basically trying to treat this like an episode of Law and Order.
No, right? I think that's right. And will not play well with some people.
It won't play well with some people, but this isn't geared for some people.
Well,
this is geared for a whole different subset of voters and viewers out there.
But they're the ones, in my view. I mean, you and I, we pretty much got our minds made up. And I think that, you know, our BS detector is telling us that what we're hearing out of these hearings is legit.
Right.
Okay. But I think the people who they've got to reach are the ones who are sitting there who think, all right, I'm open to hear this. I don't think that Congress or Democrats have been very fair to Donald Trump, but I'll listen. And I'm afraid that they come away from this saying, this was so one-sided. Nobody said a kind word about Donald Trump. Nobody in all these hearings was there to stand up and say, well, wait, I don't know. You know, using your example,
right.
Bill Barr, you know, you said he was out of his mind. Well, you know, that's easy to say, Mr. Barr, Attorney General. But what does that mean? What really made you think he was out of his mind? I think that's missed. And I think that is going to leave a certain segment of the population feeling like this whole thing was just one giant setup.
That's it. That's interesting. I'm not convinced that voters are going to be that invested in
you
this.
You could very well be right about that.
In this, to sort of come to the conclusion that you just did, although I can definitely see that conclusion being met, you know, by at least a fraction of those viewers out there. How do you then, so you're looking at the overall narrative of this hearing, Liz Cheney, in my view, has just on the first ring of the bell, threw down the gauntlet with the Republican Party and saying, you know, when she said Trump will go away. Someday he will be gone.
Yeah, right.
But your involvement here, what you did, will
be remembered.
That will be remembered. And I think that to me was a very compelling moment. And everybody, of course, was started then, you know, literally on Twitter and outside and Facebook and places like that. Well, you know, she's down 30 points in her district at home. She could give a shit whether she was down 30
apparently,
points.
Apparently.
She could care less. Because
she knew where she was going. She knew where she was going.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So you have moments like that I think are crystallizing moments. You have the overarching nature of this that I think in the main, this has not come off as the Republicans would have hoped as this partisan hack job.
Right.
Again, taking into account your point about not having a counter narrative, but I don't know what the hell that counter narrative would be since we lived through the shit.
Right.
We all lived through January 6th. I don't know. I would love to have one of those folks get up and sort of make the case for legitimate political discourse.
See, but you're kind of on my point now. That's right. You know, we're not here. We've heard the arguments
right.
from those who want to dismiss January 6th as a rally or whatever the heck it is. I want to see them as witnesses in front of the committee or have someone on the committee raise those points.
Right.
Because I think they need to be taken apart. And the format is such that it's not really allowing for that. And the people who they want as witnesses who would go there, well, they're turning their noses up at the subpoenas. They're not going to show up.
Right, right. So you've had a couple of takeaways from this, and I'd love to get your thoughts and reactions to them. One of them, which I thought was acutely profound and so true because it sums up so much about Donald Trump, was that all the evidence clearly indicated he was told,
yes,
you lost the election, there was no fraud, et cetera, et cetera. And yet he didn't care.
Right.
He continued to prosecute the matter. What do you think that says? You are a former judge, lawyer. So, the idea of things like mens rea, the mind, how people come into these situations, what their intent is. How do you read that narrative from those who were in the room with him?
You hit on such an important point. And this was actually the basis of a discussion I had with my son-in-law's father, who is a trained lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And I was making the point, no, you know what? He said, when they come up with all this stuff, there's no way the Justice Department can't go forward with a criminal prosecution. To which I said, there is every way the Justice Department cannot go forward with a criminal prosecution. Number one, it's not a crime to disagree with everybody who works for you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, you've got to show that he intended to commit a crime. There's two parts, as you just pointed out. There's the actus reus, which is the act itself, and the mens rea, which is the criminal intent. Well, proving that Donald Trump intended to act as a criminal is no small thing to do. Now, you and I can sit here and we can smile because we know full well that he intended to do exactly what he did. But you know what? Proving that in a court of law is not an easy chore.
Right.
And it's not something the Justice Department is going to take on unless they feel pretty damn confident that they can prove it. So far, have you heard any evidence that would prove that he acted with criminal intent?
To be honest, not really. I mean, I think it is difficult for that element, those elements required to bring a prosecution to be met. Now, we say this after two hearings. The
True.
Third hearing has been suspended and will postponed and will be probably later in the week or next week. But after the first two hearings, I don't think there's enough there. We'll see what else they put on the table.
Fair enough, absolutely.
We don't know based on what's come through the door right now that there is evidence of an intent. I think, although I can, to a certain degree, Rick, make the case that when you have so many different levels of individuals in their capacity, official capacities, from his legal counsel to the Justice Department to White House counsel, all these folks coming and saying no. And then Trump taking the steps, as we know them so far, of having to replace some of those individuals with people who would tell him yes.
But that to me
gets pretty damn close to mens rea.
But what's the crime?
Oh, the crime is fomenting insurrection. The crime is overturning an election. The crime is stopping a congressional action.
I don't see the connection.
The crime. The crime is in Georgia. Find me 11,000 votes.
That's very different. I agree. I mean, the whole Georgia thing, I think you set aside separately, because I think that is, if Donald Trump is going to be prosecuted for a crime, it's in Georgia.
My thinking is, if he wants you to set aside 11,000 votes in Georgia, you're not that far from removed from, can y'all put those sons of bitches on?
But you've got to prove it.
I think it's there. I think there's evidence there. I don't think the fight right now inside this commission is, and you saw it play out in the last 24 hours between Chairman Benny Thompson and Vice Chairman Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney seems to have more people on her side than Benny Thompson does when it comes to getting a criminal referral to the Justice Department. So you don't do that unless you know, or at least you think, based on the evidence you have, that there's a there, right?
So I want people to be clear on this, because it can be so confusing. Just for the sake of clarity, yes, I do believe that Donald Trump not only committed a crime, he committed numerous crimes.
Correct.
But the point that I'm making is, no matter what you may think about that, it is such a far cry from proving it in a court of law. Right. They are night and day, two different worlds. And from what I've seen so far, and you're right, there's a lot more to come. And there may be that smoking gun where Trump said, you know, to somebody who's going to testify, yeah, he said to me, I know I lost, but I'm going to keep this going because I'm going to raise a lot of money that I can use for other things. Now you're getting somewhere. There's such a distinction between what we all, through our common sense.
All intent is not manifested by words.
No, it's not. That's right.
And I can tell you from firsthand experience and knowledge, Donald Trump doesn't work that way. Never has. Right. Donald Trump is always, this is why he doesn't do email. He doesn't write stuff down. He doesn't want to leave a paper trail in that regard. But everyone who works for Donald Trump knows what that means. And
no, I get it. I understand. But listen, put yourself on a jury in that case, and you get these very same witnesses in front of saying, yeah, I told him. I was his campaign chairman, and I told him. So-and-so told him. All of these big political people told him that he lost the election. And he gets there and he says, yeah, but you know what you're forgetting is people like Rudy Giuliani told me that I had won. People like so-and-so told me that I had won. Now, maybe who I chose to listen to, in your view, may have been the wrong choices. But I don't think I committed a crime when I decided that Rudy Giuliani was in a better position to know.
But Rudy Giuliani wasn't in a better position to know, because Rudy was drunk half the time, number one.
I understand that.
And number two, both Rudy and what's her name?
Powell.
They were the ones who were purveyors of the bullshit, of the lies.
You're right about all of that. And nevertheless, Donald Trump can be a fool. He can be an idiot for listening to somebody who's drunk most of the time, but that doesn't make it criminal.
It does, to the extent that they know that what they're telling them, A, is a lie, B, that what they're telling them pushes the principal, in this case, Donald Trump, to respond and act in a way that is illegal. In other words, Donald Trump knew, after being told by countless people, including his daughter, probably, and his son-in-law.
Yeah, well, we know his daughter.
Right? that A, he lost the election, B, there was no fraud, to then continue to perpetuate that lie in order to achieve an illicit end, right, which is to have the Congress step down, to then say in the context of all of that, right, to, you know, Mike Pence probably deserves to die because he didn't do the thing I wanted him to do.
So wait, let's take that, because there's two ways you can interpret that.
Oh, one, Rick.
There is. One way is, yeah, he meant it. the other way is he was being a smartass.
No. See, that's where I disagree. I disagree. Donald Trump is never that. In no situations. He's never that in no situations.
Really?
No, not at least in my, not in my experience with him. And not from the people.
You understand that this entire discussion we're having is the exact discussion going on every day inside the Department of Justice.
Of course it is. Of course it is. That's why I'm having it with you.
Right. This is what they're going through.
You got two lawyers sitting here trying to talk about mens rea of a guy who's crazy as hell.
And I have talked to people inside the Department of Justice who very much have more your viewpoint.
Yeah.
And make the argument that you're making. And I have talked to some people inside the Department of Justice who have more my point of view.
Sure.
This is what they are going through.
And this is what makes it hard, so hard for Merrick Garland, because he has to be the final arbiter of which way they go.
Right.
How he reads the evidence is how they will go ultimately. Right. So it doesn't matter what the universe says. It's when he brings it all and gets it in front of him. Does he think, A, there's sufficient evidence of a crime, and B, if he prosecutes on that evidence, he can win? Because it is a huge thing to go after a former president of the United States, although I don't put much stock in that.
Right.
Because in my view is, whether you're current or former, you're no better than I am, and you're certainly no more above the law than anyone else. So do to him what you would do to me.
Let's make another separation here, because I think it's important. There is the question of whether the big lie is a criminal violation, but then there's a separate question, which is really more in the ballpark of the January 6th commission, which is, did Donald Trump knowingly, this is a different issue,
right,
did he knowingly participate in a conspiracy to create a riot inside the Capitol? That is a more focused question, and I don't know if they're going to get there or not, but that is much more provable. I'll tell you what else I think is more provable, and there are these ancillary things, and that is, did he knowingly lie to people asking for their money? We know that he got millions of dollars by saying to people, I need this money for my defense, to hold on to the presidency, when in fact he had no intention of using that money for that. We know that $60,000 of that money went to Kimberly Guilfoyle for giving a two-minute speech.
For a two-minute speech!
Right. We know that some of that money went to Trump properties. So I think that's interesting.
So
but
that,
above
that'll,
all,
yeah.
above all, Georgia.
Yeah, I think Georgia is the Achilles heel for Trump in many respects, but you do open up another avenue that was something that we didn't expect, or there was very little focus on, and that was, you know, the new crime of basically fundraising fraud.
Yes.
I can tell you, I got, because I'm on all these lists, it is no lie, between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 a.m., I could get on an average day 15 notifications from Donald Trump asking for money.
Totally.
In 4 hours.
And what would be even more interesting is to see his reasons that he gave you in those 15.
Yes.
Why he wanted it.
And it was the legal defense fund.
Right.
It was to pay for, efforts to, with his campaign, to prove that he had won the election.
Right.
It was all, you know, to stop the Democratic fraud, the Democrats' fraud. They never used that term, Democratic. So, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of suspicious reasons for it.
And we know now that none of them were real.
And none of them were real.
And I wonder if there's crimes involved there.
$250 million. All right, yeah. we're going to take a quick break and let us catch our breath, because when we come back, we're going to start talking about guns. Lord have mercy. We're having a conversation with my buddy, Rick Unger. We'll be right back after this.
What was it like to cover President Donald Trump? Hi, I'm Deborah J. Saunders, former White House correspondent for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I was not one of the stars you'd see in the front two rows of the briefing room. I was in the back of the room or standing in the aisles before I got a seat. It was not fake news. It was my life. I get up in the morning and see what the most powerful man in the world wrote on Twitter overnight or blurted out during a call-in to a morning news show, then try to make sense of it all. I should give a warning. There is adult language, although not necessarily from the mouths of adults. Covering the Trump White House feels much better in the rearview mirror. This is Trailing Trump, notes from the back of the briefing room.
Premiering June 14th on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm hanging with my brother from another mother, Mr. Rick Unger, formerly of the nationally syndicated The Rick Unger Show, formerly of the Steele and Unger, now just sort of chilling as a grandpa. Sure. And
playing with my new puppy.
And you got a new puppy?
I got a new puppy.
What kind of puppy?
It's called a peek-a-poo. Pekingese and poodle mix.
Yeah. I've heard of those. There goes man genetically messing with stuff again.
Yeah.
Okay. we'll save that for another episode. But
actually, not a peek-a-poo, a have-a-poo. Why did I say that?
An agri-poo.
A have-a-poo.
Have a poo. I have a poo.
Havanese and poodle, not peek-a-poo.
I have a poo.
It's late in the day. I start to
God
lose
bless. It. Only we could come up with something like that. So you've got right now a very interesting storyline in the Second Amendment space. And it is watching the emergence of very strong advocates on gun rights, aligning themselves with very strong advocates of gun safety and gun reform. And I, you know, give you my buddy Joe Walsh, whom I've had on the podcast recently to talk about that, as well as
we got to talk about Joe Walsh one of these days. Never have I seen somebody do such a massive turnaround.
You know, I can just real quick sidebar on that. I've talked to him about that on and off line, and it's legit. It's real.
I kind of believe that.
He realizes that, yeah, I was on the wrong side of history. I was standing on the wrong side of history on a number of things. And he used, you know, and we talk about the fact that the Joe Walsh that I worked with and helped get elected in 2010 in his congressional district in Illinois was a very different guy than the one who left Washington a few years later.
That can happen. So
a lot of these guys came in with very strong sentiments around the Second Amendment, but more importantly, around the Constitution, big government republicanism that was formed under Bush. And they had a lot of feelings about that. But yeah, it's a genuine thing for him. And he'll tell you, you know, he disagrees with David Hogg and a lot of these guys on some of the policies that they're promoting. But he thinks this is the moment to build a consensus around the things that we actually can get done. So but that's
it's interesting because I track him. Right.
Right.
And there's enough inconsistencies in his various views towards policies to make me believe he's for real.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the way, right? That's how you can begin to see, okay, is this guy blowing smoke or is there something real here?
Yeah.
He, you know, so you have him, you have others, you have the Gun Owners of America, which is the huge rival to the National Rifle Association. You have these interesting partnerships that are starting to form. What's your take on this newly emerged Second Amendment battle, particularly in light of the impending Supreme Court decision on the New York case? Which, by the way, is a quick sidebar. You know it better than I. Basically, if the Supreme Court's rules the way people believe, that it would allow for you to own a gun without a, you can carry a gun without a permit.
Without a permit. It's in an interesting place right now. And, you know, like everybody else, there's always two sides to my thinking. One side is the less pragmatic,
right,
which is, I can't believe that we're having this big of a fight to get this little in the way of what appears to be some improvements.
What's emerging, right?
Yeah. On the but the other side is, well, you know what? I may find that to be ridiculous, but that doesn't change the reality.
Right.
And the reality is what the reality is. It's going to be a long time, if ever, that we end up with a Congress and a White House that are really, really, really made up of numbers that are going to take on the gun problem in a serious way. Just not going to happen. And so since it's just not going to happen, then it's good to see that their attention was grabbed to the point where they're making some modifications, although I know that there are millions of people out there who are going, what are you talking about? They're virtually doing nothing. And I'm sympathetic to that point of view. It's tricky. I mean, the Second Amendment, with all of the fighting we do about it, it's one of the most amorphous things in our Constitution. You know, I mean, once you have to start to try and think, is what we have today really what the founders had in mind?
No, I don't think so.
Well, you know, we say no, and frankly, I agree with you. I don't think so either. But at the same time, maybe they would say, hey, our motivation for that was so that people would have the ability to fight back against the government that was repressing them. If government could stop you from getting guns, they could stop you from fighting back. So maybe of them would say it's no different today.
No,
I tend to agree with you, but.
Yeah, I think we're largely on the same page on this. And you know, I've been a strong supporter of gun rights and gun ownership, et cetera. So, you know, no secret there for me. I'm all about responsible ownership and responsible laws that mitigate against, right, you know, some of the things that we've seen play out, you know, whether it's in the health, the mental health space, et cetera. But I think of my reading of that amendment, I'm a time, place, circumstance guy, as you know. I'm all about, and I don't like projecting back into the past, today's attitudes about big decisions that were made then. I take them for what they are. They are history. They have a historical context to them. And my interpretation would align itself with the view that, yeah, they wanted the farmers, right?
Yeah.
Who would form the militia, yes, necessary to fight an aggressive government. Keeping, right, in mind, the original intent was not to separate from England.
Correct.
Right. So I think, right, we kind of lose sight of that after the Declaration of Independence.
That's a really important point.
You know, the goal was not to separate. In fact, right, even during the fight for independence, there were a whole lot of colonists who were like, I'm not down with separating, right, from England. Some even went back to England because they didn't want. So I think it was this idea that if England decides to get ugly because England started passing laws saying that the colonists couldn't own weapons, right?
Right.
They were like, wait a minute, how do we then defend ourselves against you if you decide?
See, now I can make the argument, it would be half-hearted because I don't believe the argument.
Right.
But I can make the argument that those same concerns can exist today.
But here's the difference. The farmers needed to have the weapons so that when they were called into militia to defend, because there was no standing army at the time.
There was nobody to give them any weapons.
There was no one to give them any weapons. If the U.S. or the colonists, the 13 colonies had a standing army. Is that, you know, in a lot of the civilization games, one of the first things you do is you send out one person to go farm a field, right? And then every other resource is put towards building a standing army.
Right.
That's right? True. And so if there was a standing army by this fledgling government or the 13 colonies who were in confederation together, that probably would have been a very different amendment, because this was a matter of getting the farmer to put down the plow to pick up the musket and to join up at point A to go fight against this enemy. And when that fight was over, take that musket, put it back on the shelf, and go back to plowing.
Yeah, very interesting point.
Anyway.
Very interesting point.
So now that we've had a little history lesson.
Well, see, that this is just it. There's just so much we don't, even if you are an originalist, even if you believe in a strict interpretation,
right?
There's so much we don't know, because guess what? Them folks are dead.
Right.
They can't tell us, right?
So we've got 20 members of the United States Senate, 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans, who've now come together around a framework, which everyone seems to be patting themselves in the back for and applauding. Do you think it does anything? I mean, at the end of the day, what are we talking about? A couple of red flag law positions?
That's a little. It does a little. A very little. I mean, yeah, it incentivizes the states to pass red flag laws. I think that's a good idea. It does increase background checks between 18 and 21. Obviously, a step in the right direction. A lot of little steps.
Yeah.
More money for mental health.
They sort of backslid a little bit. Instead of saying, okay, if you're 21 years old, you can go out and buy a weapon. If you're under 21, you can't. Oh, no, we're going to do a range between 18 and 21, because they still want 18-year-olds to be able to go out and buy a freaking weapon.
AR-15, right.
They still want them to be able to go and do that. Right. But that same 18-year-old can't go in the liquor store and buy liquor.
That's right. That's right.
So I can, on my 18th birthday, go get an AR-15 because I'm now found to be somehow of sound mind.
I can go shoot the liquor store owner, but I cannot buy any liquor.
Right. I can go shoot the liquor store owner, but I can't buy liquor from his establishment.
Now, I mean, look, logic has nothing to do with this. This is 190% pure politics and chicken shit members of Congress who are so afraid that they're just not going to do anything to, as Mel Brooks would put it, endanger their phony baloney jobs.
How do you think all of this at the final moment? We are 4 months out. What is this, June? July, August, September, October. Yeah, 4 months out from the midterm elections. You've got big gun decision out of New York coming down the Supreme Court, abortion decision coming down from the Supreme Court, an affirmative action case coming down from the Supreme Court that will likely, again, eviscerate affirmative action as we know it.
Right.
Then you've got the January 6th commission going on, and more work to come, but by the 30th of June, we should have a better, clearer view of exactly what that was all about, and whether, to our earlier discussion, there was any indictable material. Where do you think all this leads the country going into the midterms?
Back to what the only thing that really matters in the midterms: gas prices and food prices. That's all that matters.
Man, we can't be that dumb.
You know, but that's it. That's all that'll matter. Let's face it. Is
you think
a
that's a good? Do you think that's a good
a Democrat?
Right. Do you think that's a good place to be?
I think most of the positions Americans hold is not a good place to be, because we're not educated. All of those Supreme Court cases you just brought up, each and every one of them extremely important, and the only one that will be in voters' minds when they go to the polls, if at all, will be the abortion case.
Yeah.
That'll have some impact. It'll certainly bring out some women to vote that maybe wouldn't have voted otherwise. The rest of them, I doubt that 90% of the population will have even heard of them. All that will matter is, gas prices, and food prices.
I've been asking this question to the audience as I get to chat before, and that is, have we reached a point that when asked, do you value the price of gas more than democracy? Do you value, less inflation over voting rights? My fear is your answer is your point. I would rather have $2 gas and not be able to vote.
But see, every one of those people you ask that question is going to answer.
I'm not saying I will, but the answer is, I want to clarify for my audience. I'm not saying I would have.
No. But anybody who you ask that question to, they're all going to give you the same answer. No, of course I value democracy more than the price of gas.
Right.
What a ridiculous question. And they're lying their butts off. They are lying their butts off because they don't even see the connection. They don't see the connection.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point, Rick. They don't. I fear you're right there. They really don't. Because I put it out to a friend of mine, a Trumper guy I was talking to, and I told him, I said, you realize, because he's all hyped up about, oh yeah, you know, we're going to own the libs, you know. It's like, you rhino, you chose the wrong side. I'm like, you know, I'm going to smack the shit out of you, keep talking. But the reality of it is, you know, his argument was, we're going to, you know, people are going to be fixated on gas, the price of gas, and be fixated on inflation, and they're going to give us the power back.
He's probably right.
And I'm sure he's right. And then of course, they're like, then what are you going to do with it when you get it? Oh, we're holding the Biden administration accountable. Yeah. We're, you know, Hunter Biden needs to account. I said, so at the same time, Hunter's accounting, should the Trump children account for the fact that they made 700, 800 million, a billion dollars during the 4 years that they were in Washington?
But you see, what I see more telling in his answer, what's he talking about, Hunter Biden? I don't give a crap about Hunter Biden. Is a junkie who's had a pretty icky life brought on by himself.
Right.
And he's not the president of the United States. I couldn't give a rat's patootie about Hunter Biden. I don't know him. I don't like what he is. And guess what? It has absolutely nothing to do with his father. You can argue that maybe his father wasn't the best father if his son turned out to be a junkie. I would argue something very much in opposition to that based on empirical evidence.
Right.
Nevertheless, it's not relevant to the conversation. Just to, you know, I mean, the only reason Trump's kids became relevant is because they went to work in his administration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they got very politically involved. I have yet to see a tweet from Hunter Biden extolling the virtues of his dad. He's not politically involved. Who gives a crap? And in terms of owning the libs, which is the number one goal, what the hell does that mean? Yeah, the Republicans are going to take control. I think Republicans may very well win the White House again. You don't own me. My life isn't going to change just because I'm a liberal and we lost elections. I mean, come on.
Well, you hope it doesn't.
It's not gonna.
Yeah. Well, I, it's, you know, gonna. this crowd is hell bent on a different mission.
It's something very
problematic.
My honest answer to that, though, is it is going to change lives, not mine.
Yeah, well, I may not change yours personally, but it'll change your grandkids. It'll change your kids.
It may.
I
doubt it, but I know there are millions of Americans whose lives will be changed to the worse. In other words, what I'm basically saying, I am white and privileged. Okay, I am not going to be the one to suffer.
Right.
But there are many people who are not as privileged, and it will change their lives.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that is the rub going into this fall's elections. In my view, is how you. I value my democracy, our democracy, way more than gas prices and the like, because I know gas prices will come down, inflation will recede, But democracy, when it's damaged, injured, or absolutely taken away, you don't recover from that.
Couldn't possibly agree more.
Yeah.
That's a fact. And you know, you get into this discussion with people over Ukraine. I don't think we're sending them enough help.
I agree.
If it pushes up the price.
I agree 1,000%.
Americans can't view things as temporary. Right. Whatever is happening at this moment, oh my God, it's going to be that way forever. It's horrible. I can't believe it. And it's crazy.
It is.
It's always temporary. Inflation. Yeah, it got worse than I had predicted that it would. I thought it was transient. I was wrong.
All right.
But it's temporary.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not going to be this way forever.
It isn't.
We have no patience or ability to withstand difficult times.
No, we are not our grandparents' children.
No, we are not.
We are not, because those folks went from recession to World War, I mean, to the Great Depression to World War II, and built an economy that we have utterly ruined.
Very nicely put. Built an economy that we benefited from enormously. And proceeded to screw it up.
That sure did.
We're a bunch of lazy people who will not sacrifice. Everything is for the present moment. It's terrible. It's a shame. Yeah,
I just had that conversation this morning about sacrifice. We are not a generation of people who sacrifice at all. And
can you remember one time, and you and I have been around a while, right? Can you remember one time when our government has legitimately asked us to sacrifice and we did it?
Not since December 1941.
Yeah, that's right.
That was the last time.
Took a shot at it.
He took a shot, and we beat the shit out of him.
Turn our thermostat down, and we threw him out of office.
Turn the thermostat down. What the hell's wrong with you? I'm not sitting around my house in some damn sweater when I can just turn the heat up to 75.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's who we are now.
Rick Unger, I love you, brother. I really do. I appreciate having you back on and spending some time with us, man. I really, really do. You're a great buddy, great American out there. And I hope you continue to enjoy your quiet time.
The puppy's right here by my side. The puppy's right there. We're going to go for a
walk. What do you have, a havadoodle?
That's it. Have a poodle. Have a doodle. That's exactly what it is.
All right, folks. Poodle. That does it for this time with Michael Steele and Rick Unger. Really appreciate you being with us as always. If you like this podcast, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps me out. It makes a brother feel good. You can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. You can find Rick Unger on Twitter. He can be found at Rick Unger. That's UNGAR.
And boy, I've trained you well over all these years.
You have, my friend. You have, Padawan. And don't forget to check out our podcast on Twitter at Steele_podcast. Until next time, y'all, be safe, be well. Enjoy the summer, because it's hot as hell out there.
It is hot.
All right, Rick, later.
All right, brother.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.